Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Frank Abagnale, author of several books, including The Art of the Steal, Stealing Your Life, and his autobiography, written with Stan Redding, Catch Me If You Can, which was made into a major motion picture in 2002, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hanks, directed by Steven Spielberg. Mr. Abagnale has advised the FBI for over four decades on how to outsmart con artists. In recent years, he's joined forces with the AARP Fraud Watch Network and AARP Nebraska. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 10, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of AARP, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to speak on the topic, Stealing Your Life, is Frank Abagnale.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to have all of you here this evening. Thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us. We'll get that music off here in a minute. There we go. And all the folks in the overflow room that I got to visit with a few minutes ago, thank you very much for coming out this evening. To start out tonight, I'm always asked if I'll talk a little bit about my life, and AARP has asked me to do that this evening, and then I certainly will get into the subject of identity theft and hopefully give you a great deal of information to take home and help protect you and your families from that particular crime. And, of course, I will take questions afterwards, and you can ask me any questions about identity theft or other concerns you have or any questions about the movie, anything you like. We'll take those questions, and they have microphones on either side. Now, as many of you know, I've had a lot of people tell my story. I had a great writer write a book about my life, great film director make a movie about my life, a great Broadway musical team make a Tony Award-winning Broadway musical about my life, and, of course, a great television show, White Collar, on TV created around my life. Most of those very creative people have actually never met me personally. So I always felt that they liked telling my story from their point of view. So I thought tonight I would just tell you the story from my point of view. I was raised just north of New York City in Westchester County, New York. I was actually one of four children in the family, the so-called middle child of the four. I was educated there by the Christian Brothers of Ireland at a private Catholic school called Iona in New Rochelle, New York, where I went to school from kindergarten to high school. By the time I had reached the age of 16, in the 10th grade, my parents, after 22 years of marriage one day, decided to get a divorce. Unlike most divorces where the children were usually the first to know, my parents were very good about keeping that a secret. I remember being in the 10th grade one afternoon when the father walked into the classroom and asked a brother to excuse me from class. When I came out in the hallway, the father handed me my books and told me that one of the brothers would drive me to the county seat in White Plains, New York, where I would meet my parents and they would explain what was going on. I remember the brother dropped me at the steps of a big stone building and told me to go on up the steps and that my parents would be waiting for me in the lobby. I remember climbing the steps, seeing a sign on the building that said Family Court, but I really didn't understand what that meant. When I arrived in the lobby, my parents were not there, but I was ushered into the back of an immense courtroom where my parents were standing before a judge. I couldn't hear what the judge was saying, nor my parents' response. But eventually the judge saw me at the back of the room and he motioned me to approach the bench. I walked up to stand in between my parents. I remember distinctly that the judge never looked at me. He never acknowledged I was standing there. He just simply read from his papers and said that my parents were getting a divorce. Because I was 16 years of age, I would need to tell the court which parent I chose to live with. I started to cry, so I turned and ran out of the courtroom. Judge called for a 10-minute recess, but by the time my parents got outside, I was gone. My mother never saw me again for about 7 years until I was a young adult. Contrary to the movie, my father never saw me or ever spoke to me again. In the mid-1960s, running away was a very popular thing for young people. A lot of them got caught up in Haight-Ashbury, the hippie scene, the drug scene. Instead, I took a few belongings from my home, packed them in a bag, boarded what was then the New Haven and Hartford Railroad for the short train ride down to Grand Central Terminal in New York. My father did own a stationery store, but actually in Manhattan, located on the corner of 40th and Madison. Like all of us, we had to work in that store, so from the time I was about 13, I made deliveries for my dad. I knew the city very well, so I started looking for the same type of work. There were a lot of signs on the windows, stock boy, delivery boy, part-time. I'd walk in and apply. So tell me, young man, how old are you? 16. How far did you go in high school? 10th grade. I'll hire you. And I went to work for a small amount of money, a few hours a day, but I soon realized I couldn't support myself on that amount of money. I also realized that as long as people believed I was 16 years old, they weren't going to pay me any more money. At 16, I was 6 foot tall. I've always had a little gray hair. My friends used to say in school that once a week when we dressed for mass, I looked more like a teacher than a student. So I decided to lie about my age. In New York, we had a driver's license at 16, but back then they didn't have a photo on it, just an IBM card, so I altered one digit of my date of birth. I was actually born in April of 1948, but I dropped the 4, converted it to a 3, and that made me 10 years older or 26 years old. I walked around applying for the same type of work. People gave me a little more money, a few more hours, but even then it was difficult to make ends meet. One of the few things I had taken when I left home was a checkbook. My father had opened a checking account for me at a small community bank in Mount Vernon, New York. I had a little money in that account, so every so often I would write a check to supplement my income. $20, $25, the funds were there, the checks were good. But it was my friends, my peers, who would say to me, "You know, you're the only guy who walks into a bank in the middle of Manhattan. You have no account there. You don't know a soul. You talk to somebody behind the desk and they okay your check." "Oh, well, my checks are good. And when I walked in that bank, they wouldn't touch my check. You walk in, they don't bat an eye." Years later, reporters would say that that was my upbringing, mannerisms, dress, appearance, speech. Whatever it was very easy to do. So consequently, when the money ran out, I kept writing those checks. Of course, the checks started to bounce. Police were looking for me as a runaway. I thought maybe it was a good time to start thinking about leaving New York City. But I was quite apprehensive about going to Chicago or Miami, wondered if they'd cash a New York check on a New York driver's license in Miami as quickly as they did in Manhattan. I was walking up 42nd Street one afternoon about 5 o'clock in the evening, 16 years old, pondering all of these things when I started to approach the front door of a old hotel that used to be there called the Commodore Hotel, now the Grand Hyatt. Just as I was about to get to the front door of the hotel, out stepped an Eastern Airline flight crew onto the sidewalk. I couldn't help but notice the captain, the co-pilot, the flight engineer, about 3 or 4 flight attendants dragging their bags to the curb to load them in the van to take them to the airport. As they loaded the van, I thought to myself, that's it. I could pose as a pilot. I could travel all over the world for free. I probably could get just about anybody, anywhere, to cash a check for me. So I walked up the street a little further to 42nd and Park. I crossed over. I heard a huge helicopter. I looked up, and there was New York Airways landing on the roof of the Pan Am building. Pan Am, the nation's flag carrier, the airline that flew around the world. I thought, what a perfect airline to use. So the next day, I placed a phone call to the executive corporate offices of Pan Am. When the switchboard was ringing, I had absolutely no idea what I was going to say. When they answered, "Pan American Airlines, good morning, can I help you?" "Yes, ma'am. I'd like to speak to somebody in the purchasing department." "Purchasing? One moment." And the clerk came on and said, "Yes, sir, maybe you can help me. My name is John Black. I'm a co-pilot with the company based out of San Francisco. Been with the company about 7 years. Never had anything like this come up before." "What's the problem?" "Well, we flew a trip in here yesterday. We're going out today. Yesterday, I sent my uniform out through the hotel to have it dry clean. Now the hotel and the cleaner say they can't find it. Here I am with a flight in about 4 hours, no uniform." "Don't you have a spare uniform?" "Certainly, back home in San Francisco, but I'd never get it here in time for my flight." "Do you understand that this would cost you the price of a uniform, not the company?" "I understand." "Hold on, I'll be right back." And he came back and said, "My supervisor says you need to go down to the well-built uniform company on Fifth Avenue. They're our supplier. I'll call them and let them know you're on the way." Well, that's exactly what I wanted to know, so I went down to the well-built uniform company. Little fella Mr. Rosen fitted me out in the uniform. They were black gabardine, the 3 gold stripes on the arm, the gray hair. I certainly looked old enough to be the pilot. When he was all done, I said, "How much do I owe you?" "Well, the uniform's $286. I said, "No problem, I'll write you a check." "No, we can't take any checks." "Oh, well then I'll just pay you cash." "No, we can't accept cash. You need to fill out this computer card. Then in these boxes put your employee number. Then we bill this back under uniform allowance. Comes out of your next Pan Am paycheck." "Well, that's even better. Go ahead and do that." New York had 2 airports, LaGuardia and Kennedy. LaGuardia was 20 minutes from Manhattan. Kennedy was 50. Naturally, LaGuardia being the closer of the two, that's where I went. I spent most of the morning walking around LaGuardia in the uniform, trying to figure out, now that I had the uniform, How the hell do you get on these planes? But I got a little hungry about lunchtime, so I walked in the luncheonette, sat down at the counter on a stool, and ordered a sandwich. Moments later, a TWA crew walked in. Flight attendants sat in the booth, but the pilots up at the counter on either side of me, captain right next to me. Now, back before deregulation of the airlines, airline people thought of themselves as just one big family. They didn't hesitate a moment to talk to each other, and the captain kind of leaned over. Hey, young man, how's Pan Am doing?
Doing just fine, Captain.
Tell me, what's Pan Am doing out here at LaGuardia? Pan Am doesn't fly into LaGuardia, they only fly into Kennedy. Well, I picked up on that right away.
Yeah, we came into Kennedy, had a short layover, came over to visit some friends of mine. Matter of fact, I'm on my way back to Kennedy now.
So tell me, young man, what type of equipment are you on?
Now, airline people have a lot of jargon for things. One of them is they never call a plane or plane or an aircraft. They call it equipment, and what type of equipment you're on meant what type of plane do you fly. Back then, a DC-8, a 707. Of course, I didn't know that, and I thought, what type of equipment am I on? The equipment I'm on is a stool. They must mean what type of equipment is on the planes I fly. So I thought, well, they've got the wings, they've got the engine. They always had a sticker on the engine, who manufactured the engine. So I said, yes, General Electric. All three pilots kind of just stopped eating and leaned over. Captain said, oh, really? What do you fly, washing machine? So I knew I said the wrong thing. Out the door I went. Everybody had an airline ID card, plastic, laminated card, much like a driver's license today. Without the ID card, the uniform was worthless. Went back to Manhattan pretty discouraged, thinking, where would I come up with a Pan American airline corporate ID? I was sitting in the hotel room. I noticed a big, thick Manhattan Yellow Pages on the dresser, so I pulled them down on the bed, flipped them open, and looked under the word identification. There were three or four pages of companies who made convention badges, metal badges, plastic badges, police badges, fire badges. Started to call around, and finally one company said, listen, most of those airline IDs manufactured by Polaroid, 3M company, need to call one of them. Finally got the 3M company on the phone in Manhattan. Yeah, we manufacture Pan Am's identification system, along with a number of other airlines. How come? Tell you, I'm a purchasing officer for a major U.S. carrier. I'm in New York just for the day. And we're getting ready to expand our routes, hire a lot of new employees, go to a formal ID. We're very impressed with this Pan Am format. Wondered if I came by your office this afternoon briefly, we could discuss quantity and price. By all means, come on by. So I went by dressed in a suit, and the sales rep opened the book. Yeah, we do United, Delta, Braniff, National, Eastern, Pan Am. Pan Am, we like this Pan Am format. Wonder if you have a sample I could bring back. Sure, I'll be right back. And he brought me back a 5x7 glossy piece of paper with a picture of an ID card blown up in the middle of it. Someone else's picture in the picture. John Doe for a name. And bold ink across the front, this is a sample only. I said, no, I'm afraid this won't do. You know, I need to bring back an actual physical card. By the way, what is all this equipment on the floor? Oh, no, we don't just sell these cards. We sell the system, camera, laminator. I said, we have to buy all this? Absolutely. I'll tell you what, since we have to buy it all, I wanted to just demonstrate how it works and use me. Fine, have a seat right here. Took my picture, made up the card, and the door I went. I was going down the elevator studying the card. It had a blue border across the top, about a quarter of an inch in Pan Am's color blue, but not a single thing on the card said Pan Am. No logo, no insignia, no company name. This was a plastic card, like a credit card. You couldn't type on it, couldn't write on it, couldn't print on it. Discouraged, I put it in my pocket. Headed back to the hotel. As I was walking back, I noticed that I had passed a hobby shop, so I turned around and walked back. Excuse me, sir, I see you sell a lot of models here. Sell models of commercial jetliners? Sure, over there. And I bought a model of a Pan Am 707 cargo jet for about $2.40, took it back to my room, opened the box, threw all the parts out. But there at the bottom of the box was a sheet of decals that went on the model. And when soaked in a glass of water, the blue Pan Am globe that would have went on the tail of the plastic plane went perfect up at the top of the plastic card. And the word Pan Am and the special styling of graphics that would have went on the fuselage went perfect across the top of the card. And the clear decal on the laminated plastic made a beautiful identification card. Pan Am says they estimate that between the ages of 16 and 18 that I flew more than 1 million miles for free, boarded more than 260 commercial aircraft in more than 26 countries around the world. Pan Am says, keep in mind that though Frank Abagnale did in fact pose as one of our pilots, he never once stepped on board one of our aircraft. That's true. I never flew on Pan Am because I was afraid someone might say to me, you know, I'm based in San Francisco, been out there 22 years, I don't recall ever meeting you before. Or someone might say, you know, your ID card is not exactly like my ID card. So instead, I flew on everyone else. If I wanted to go somewhere, I literally just walked out to the airport and looked on the board, United Flight 800 to Chicago. Then I went downstairs, the door marked United Operations, and walked in. The operations clerk, hey, Pan Am, what can we do for you? I was wondering if the jump seats open on 800. I need to get it to Chicago. Jump seat, it's open this evening. I'd like to get a pink slip pass. I'd give my ID, he'd write me out a pass. I'd walk out, hand it to the flight attendant. She'd open the door to the cockpit, and I'd step in. They had a captain, a co-pilot, a flight engineer in the seat behind the captain called the jump seat, where pilots deadhead on company time. Now, because pilots love to talk shop, once you picked up that jargon, it was the same conversation over and over and over. So I just step on board, Imogen, Bob Davis, be riding in Chicago. On the taxi out, always the same question. So, Bob, how long you been with Pan Am? Been flying about 7 years. What position you fly? A right seat, which is airline terminology for a co-pilot. What type of equipment are you on? Had that one down. Perfect. Matter of fact, whatever they flew, I didn't fly. So I had no problems with that. When I arrived in Chicago, I'd go by the Pan Am ticket counter, but just enough to get the attention of the passenger service rep. So can I help you? Excuse me, where do we lay over here? The dead at a trip or somebody got ill? Never laid over in Chicago. So we use the Parma House Hilton downtown. Catch the crew bus lower level door 3 up. I go down the Parma House Hilton, walk in, and on the corner of the registration desk, a little sign said Airline Cruise. That was a 3-ring binder. You signed in, referenced your flight number, showed your ID, they'd give me a key, I'd stay 2 or 3 days. Pan Am would be direct billed for my room and my meals. I also could cash a personal check up to $100 at the hotel because the airline had a contract with the hotel, and they'd cash your check. But then I found out that every airline honors every other airline employee's personal check, a reciprocal agreement still practiced today in 2015. So a Delta flight attendant can walk over to an American ticket counter, show her Delta ID, and cash a personal check as a courtesy up to $100 and vice versa. Of course, when I found that out, I'd go out to JFK or LAX, only I'd go to everybody, Northeast, National, KLM, Air France. It would take me a good 8 hours, stopping at every counter in every building. By the time I got all the way around the other end of the airport, at least 8 hours had gone by. But what do you have in 8 hours? Shift change, new people. So I'd go all the way back around the other way again. The only reason I stopped is the FBI issued a John Doe warrant for interstate transportation of fraudulent checks. The John Doe warrant meant the FBI didn't know my identity. In the warrant, the FBI said, based on interviews with people I had personal contact with, I was approximately 30 years old. I was 18. Had a great deal of money, so I hung the uniform up and moved to Atlanta, Georgia. In Atlanta, I moved into a very swank singles complex that had just been built there called the Riverbend Apartment. On the application for the lease, there were a lot of questions for a teenage boy. One of them was occupation. I began to write down airline pilot, but the next question said employed by, supervisor's name, telephone contact. I thought to myself, I'll need to come up with something that would be impossible to check out. Yet something that would justify why I drive an expensive car, wear expensive clothes, don't work much. So I wrote down the word doctor. First thing came to my mind, had a very inquisitive apartment manager. Oh, I see you're a doctor. Yes, ma'am. What type of doctor are you? Well, I'm a medical doctor. However, I'm not practicing medicine right now. I left my practice out in Los Angeles to come to Atlanta to invest in some real estate I have. I won't be practicing for a while. How interesting. Well, tell me, what type of medical doctor are you? And I figured being a singles complex, pediatrician would be pretty safe. So I moved in, Dr. Frank Williams, pediatrician. Everybody called me Doc. Always the typical questions at the pool. So, Doc, where'd you go to medical school? At Columbia University in New York. Where'd you serve your internship? At Harvard Children's Hospital out in L.A. Once in a while, when the guys would come by, hey, Paul, hey, Doc, look at my leg. I don't know what I did to it. Look at this. Paul, I can't examine your leg. You need to go to your own doctor, have him look at that. When the girls came by, I always gave them a thorough examination, sent them on their way. I was young, but not stupid. I was living there for about 3 months. Everything was going great. One afternoon, there was a knock on my door. A very distinguished gentleman, mid-50s, standing there. Yes, I could help you. You're Dr. Williams? Yes. My name's Gordon. Just moved in the apartment down below. Wanted to come up and introduce myself. A new neighbor. Come on in. I'm not only a new neighbor, I understand you're a pediatrician. Yes, I'm the chief resident pediatrician of the county hospital up the street. Dr. Gordon was going through divorce, just separated from his wife. He was very upset, very lonely. Every day on the way to the car, out to the pool, he'd stop you. And after a minute or two about the weather, he'd start speaking medical terminology. Not being able to converse with him, I in turn would cut him short. But I knew eventually he'd get suspicious. Determined not to move, every day I went to Emory University's medical library. Every day I read the daily journals from Johns Hopkins, from the Mayo Clinic. Every day I took a certain part of the journal memorized it in detail. And every night when Dr. Gordon pulled in his parking slot, and I say this without exaggeration, every night I was sitting on his doorstep. Hey, Doc, hear about this new theory they're using up at Boston? What is it tonight? I'd follow him into his apartment. He'd go in his bedroom to get undressed. I'd go in his bedroom, sit on the edge of the bed. Be in the kitchen, I'd follow him back and forth. Pretty soon he'd come home. Hey, Doc, I don't have time to talk to you right now. I got to go. Guys started to avoid me, which is exactly what I wanted. One afternoon, I received a phone call from the hospital administrator, who is not a physician, but the administrator of the hospital. Dr. Gordon suggested I give you a call, said that you would be more than happy to help us out. Oh, what's the problem? On the midnight day shift, I have a doctor supervisor, a number of interns, nurses on that shift. He's just been notified of a death in his family. He's returning to the West Coast tomorrow for about 2 weeks. And Georgia law requires the house doctor on duty be a full practitioner or a specialist. Dr. Gordon said, you got a great deal of free time. You'd be more than happy to cover the shift in an administrative capacity. There's no way I could do that. Why not? I'm not licensed to practice medicine in the state of Georgia. Just the state of California where I hold my residency. All the red tape for 2 weeks. No red tape. We're bringing it before the Medical Review Board tomorrow morning to issue a temporary certificate. You can start tomorrow night. Now, being one who hates to pass up a challenge, I couldn't help but give it a shot, so I went up to the hospital. During my entire stay there, no one ever doubted for a second I was not a doctor. When the doctor returned, I left the hospital. I did pass the bar in the state of Louisiana, not in 2 weeks as a movie states, but in 2 months by taking the prep course that any law student would take to prepare themselves for a state bar. At the time, Louisiana did not require a law degree to take the bar. I passed the bar, went to work for Attorney General P.F. Grimion in the Civil Division of a state court, where I spent about a year. No one the wiser, on my own, I resigned and left. Of course, like any criminal, sooner or later you get caught, and I was no exception to that rule. Arrested just once in my life, at the age of 21, by the French police in a small town in southern France called Montpellier. French police arresting me on an Interpol warrant issued by the Swedish police, who were looking for me for forgery in Sweden but believed that I was living in southern France. When arrested on the Swedish warrant, the French authorities realized I had forged checks all over France, so they refused to honor the extradition request from Sweden and their warrant. They later convicted me of forgery and sent me to French prison. I served my time in a place called the Maison d'Arrêt, the House of Arrest, in a small town in southern France called Pépignan. Steven Spielberg told Barbara Walters it was extremely important to me to go back to that prison, back to the exact cell he was in and reconstructed according to the logbooks during his stay there, which he said was a blanket on the floor, no mattress, a hole in the floor to go to the bathroom, no plumbing, no electricity. He said, according to the logbooks, I entered the prison at 198 pounds, left the prison at 109 pounds. When my sentence was over, I was extradited to Sweden, where I was convicted of forgery in a Swedish court of law, and sent to a Swedish penitentiary in Malmö, Sweden. When my prison term was up in Sweden, federal authorities took custody of me and returned me to the United States. Eventually, a United States federal judge would sentence me to 12 years in federal prison. I served 4 of those 12 years at a federal prison in Petersburg, Virginia. When I was 26 years old, the government offered to take me out of prison on the condition I go to work with an agency of the federal government for the remainder of my sentence or until my parole had been satisfactorily completed. I agreed and was released. Next February, I will be celebrating 40 years with the FBI, 4 decades. I work out of Washington, D.C. I make my home in Charleston, South Carolina, and commute up to Washington on Monday and back home on Thursday. I live in Charleston with my one and only wife of 39 years and my 3 sons. My youngest boy graduated from the University of Beijing in China, went on to get his master's degree there. He reads, writes, and speaks Chinese fluently. He works for an American company and lives in Beijing. My middle son graduated from University of Nevada in Las Vegas. His degree was in hotel administration. My wife owns a business in South Carolina. He manages that business and for her. And my oldest boy, who's 36, graduated from University of Kansas at KU. He went on to Loyola School of Law in Chicago, passed the bar, and went on to make his dad very, very proud. He's an FBI agent in our Baltimore field office. He's celebrating 10 years in the FBI. He's a supervisory agent over an espionage squad out of the Baltimore field office. As many of you know, I had very little to do with the film. Based on my relationship with the government, I received no money from movies, Broadway musicals, television shows, etc. I was very pleased that in the end it was Steven Spielberg who made that film. I would have preferred not to have a film. I actually raised my 3 sons in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I lived for 25 years and commuted to Washington, D.C. But eventually, Steven Spielberg felt he wanted to tell the story. He loved the redemption side of the story, and he felt the story needed to be told. In the end, I was probably very fortunate it was he who told the story. And of course, today I get a lot of emails. Back with the movie, as went on to earn more than $1 billion for DreamWorks. It's shown over and over on television. The Broadway musical is touring over in Europe now. I won the Tony on Broadway. The television show was popular, so I always thought it would go away, but it keeps coming, and I keep getting lots of emails back in Washington, D.C. And I get emails from everybody as young as 8 to people as old as 80, and they just feel that they need to make a statement. So they watched a film on TV last week, and they send me an email. I am sure they assume I'll never see the email, nor would I respond to it, but they feel they need to write it anyway. So some write and say, you know, you were brilliant. You were an absolute genius. I was neither. I was just a child. Had I been brilliant, had I been a genius, I don't know that I would have found it necessary to break the law in order to just simply survive. And while I know that there are people fascinated by what I did some 50 years ago as a teenage boy, I've always looked upon what I did as something that was immoral, illegal, unethical, and a burden I live with every single day of my life and will until my death. There are many who write and say, well, you know, you were certainly gifted. That I was. I was one of those few children that got to grow up in the world with a daddy. The world is full of fathers. But there are very few men worthy of being called daddy by their child. I had a daddy who loved his children more than he loved life itself. Steven Spielberg would later write that the more I researched Frank's youth without ever having met Frank, I couldn't help but put his father in the film through the likes of Christopher Walken. My father was a man who had 4 children, 3 boys and a daughter. Every night at bedtime, he'd walk into your room. He was 6'3". He would drop down on one knee, kiss you on the cheek, pull the cover up, and he'd put his lip upon your earlobe, and he'd whisper deep into your ear, I love you very much. He never, ever missed a night. As I grew older, I sometimes fell asleep before he got home, but I always woke up the next morning, knew he had been by my bedside. Years later, my older brother joined me in my room. He was 6'4 in the Marine Corps and went on to play semi-pro football for Buffalo, but my father would walk around to his bed, hug him, kiss him, whisper in his ear, he loved him. When I was 16 years old, I was just a child. All 16-year-olds are just children. Much as we like them to be adults, they're just children. And like all children, they need their mother and they need their father. All children need their mother and their father. All children are entitled to their mother and their father. And though it is not popular to say so, divorce is a very devastating thing for a child to deal with and then have to deal with the rest of their natural life. For me, a complete stranger said I had to choose one parent over the other. That was a choice I could not make. So I ran. How could I tell you my life was glamorous? I cried myself to sleep till I was 19 years old. I spent every birthday, Christmas, Mother's Day, Father's Day in a hotel room somewhere in the world by myself where people didn't even speak my language. When I was ill and sick, I took care of myself, afraid that some doctor would determine my real age. The only people that associated with me were people who believed me to be their peer, 10 years older than I actually was. I never got to go to a senior prom, high school football game, or share a relationship with someone my own age. I always knew I'd get caught. Only a fool would think otherwise. The law sometimes sleeps, but the law never dies. I was caught. I went to some very bad places. My boys are grown up asking their mother, why is it Dad gets up in the middle of the night, goes down the TV room, because he doesn't turn the TV on, he just sits there all night, because there are things you can't forget, things you're not meant to forget. While I was sitting in that pitch black cell in France, my father, 57, was climbing the subway stairs of New York as he did every day. He was in great physical shape. He just happened to trip. He reached his arm out to break his fall. He slipped, hit his head on a railing, landed at the bottom of the step. He was dead. I didn't know he was dead. I was sitting in that cell thinking about him, how much I couldn't wait to see him, hold him, hug him, kiss him, tell him how sorry I was, but I never got the opportunity to do that. I was very fortunate because I was brought up in a great country where everyone gets a second chance. I owe my country 800 times more than I could ever repay it for the opportunities it's given me these past 40 years. That is why I'm at the FBI today, 32 years beyond a federal court order, to do so. I have turned down three pardons from three sitting presidents of the United States because I do not believe, nor will I ever believe, that a piece of paper will excuse my actions, that only in the end my actions will. 39 years ago, on an undercover assignment in Houston, Texas, I met my wife. When the assignment was over, I broke protocol to tell her who I really was. Didn't have a dime to my name. I eventually asked her to marry me. Against the wishes of her parents, she did. Now, I could sit up in here and tell you that I was born again, or I saw the light, or that prison rehabilitated me, but the truth is, God gave me a wife. She gave me three beautiful children. She gave me a family, and she changed my life. She and she alone. Everything I have, everything I've achieved is because of the love of a woman and the respect three boys have for their father, something I would never, ever jeopardize. There comes a time in all of our lifetimes that we grow older and we have children. And as every parent in this room knows, whether your child is 3 months old or 36 years old, when you lay your head on a pillow at night and you're just about to close your eyes, the last thing you think about, last thing you worry about, are your children. So if you still have your mother, you still have your father, you give them a hug, you give them a kiss, you tell them you love them while you can. And to those men in the audience, both young and old, I remind you what it truly is to actually be a man. It has nothing to do with money, achievements, skills, accomplishments, degrees, professions, positions. A real man loves his wife. A real man is faithful to his wife. And a real man, next to God and his country, put his wife and his children as the most important thing in his life. Steven Spielberg made a wonderful film, but I've done nothing greater, nothing more rewarding, nothing more worthwhile, nothing that's brought me more peace, more joy, more happiness, more content in my life than simply being a good husband, a good father, and what I strive to be every day of my life, a great daddy. It's been a pleasure, and God bless you. Thanks for coming this evening. Thank you. Thank you. I've written 5 books on crime. You were ready to go right into the PowerPoint?
No, that's fine. I thought you were done.
Oh, no, we're going to go. Okay. Stealing Your Life was actually the last book I wrote. I dedicated it to the Tom Hanks character who in the movie was called Carl Hanratty. The FBI agent's name was Joseph Shea. He and I remained friends for 30 years until his death at the age of 88. A wonderful man, a wonderful role model, and I dedicated Stealing Your Life to him. My first book was in 1988. It was called Crimes of the Next Generation. I was writing about crimes in the year 2000 and beyond in 1988. In Chapter 7 of the book, I wrote about identity theft. Back then, nobody really heard about such a crime. Back in 1988, there were no computers and emails and laptops, etc. But in 1988, I wrote, and I quote from the book, "There will be a time when information becomes more accessible to people. When that time comes, people will steal other people's personal information for the purpose of getting a job in their name, a mortgage in their name, buying a car in their name, or ultimately committing a crime in their name," unquote. In 1996, I wrote the second book called The Art of the Steal, and in that book talked about identity theft now getting notice and that there were people having their identity stolen. At the time of publication by Random House of the book, there were about 750,000 victims that year, and banks had lost more than $5 billion from a new crime called identity theft. By the time I got to this book in 2007, there were 15 million victims a year of publication, $60 billion in losses, and a victim every 2 seconds in the United States. I have never witnessed, nor will I ever live long enough to witness, a more simplistic crime than me stealing your identity. That would be like you asking me to count to 3. 1, 2, 3. That simple. And today, it's very difficult to be in a room with just 3 other people and somebody not say, "Oh, that happened to me. happened to my mother, happened to my brother, happened to a friend of mine. It is so common today to have one's identity stolen for so many multiple of reasons. Every day we pick up the newspaper, there's another breach. Almost every single day we have a breach. DSW, Ralph Lauren, Boston College. There have been so many breaches that all you have to do is total the numbers in those breaches, and you come to the number that every person in this room has already had their identity stolen, including me. We've already had our identity stolen. The breaches outnumber the people that live in this country. We've already had our information stolen. I live in South Carolina. About 3 years ago, someone hacked into the tax revenue office of the state of South Carolina and stole 3.8 million tax returns of the citizens of that state, including me. That was the entire physical return. So not only did they have your Social Security number, your wife's Social Security number, but if you had children and claimed them as dependents, they had their Social Security numbers, your earnings, etc. If you paid your state taxes by check, they had an image of your check. So they knew where you banked, what your account number was at the bank, your routing number into the account, your signature you used on your sick check, what check number you were on. If you paid by credit card, they had your credit card number. The day the incident occurred, I was in the FBI office in Phoenix, Arizona, when I got a call from our local network, Channel 5, and said, I don't know if you heard today about this breach at the state tax revenue office, but I'm calling to get a comment from you since obviously you're a citizen of the state. I said, I heard about the breach. Let me ask you this. What does the state tax revenue office say about the breach? They claim they did absolutely nothing wrong. Well, that would be absolutely impossible. Every breach occurs because somebody inside that company did something they weren't supposed to do or failed to do something they were supposed to do. Every breach occurs because somebody in that company did something they weren't supposed to do. 2 months later, a Secret Service investigation concluded that an employee of the tax revenue office took home a laptop they shouldn't have taken home, went online, and the hackers got into the tax revenue office. At the time, our governor, Nikki Haley, ordered credit monitoring service for every citizen of the state of South Carolina for 1 year, picked up by the state and the cost of that service from Experian. I wrote an email to the governor the next day. I don't know the governor, but as a citizen, I wrote her an email and said, 1 year of credit monitoring service is worthless. Nothing is going to happen in 1 year. People who steal mass data warehouse it. For the older it is, the more valuable it is. So they purposely put it away for 2-3 years before they start to sell bits and parts of it out in the marketplace. This is why we're just starting to see people who are a target now starting to have their identities affected that shopped at Target years later. They're always going to warehouse that information. So the governor of our state did add 2 more years to the credit monitoring service for the citizens of South Carolina. Today, all of that information is stored and warehoused away and sold off in bits parts. So 1 year of credit monitoring service is not going to do anything when it's provided to someone. It takes a much longer period of time of having that service before something would come up. We're now just starting to see some of those identities showing up now that from that tax revenue hack. When I go out during the month of October, that's Cyber Awareness Month, so I go out to usually Fortune 100 companies and speak to their employees. So they fill the cafeteria 3 times during the day, and I go out and speak to them the importance about protecting the information that's been entrusted with them, whether they be an insurance company, a government agency, whatever it may be. But when I go out to those companies, I don't park in the visitor parking lot. I park in the employee parking lot. And when I get out of the car, the first thing I do is empty both of these pockets of memory sticks and throw them all over the ground. Each one of them says confidential. Then at lunchtime, I go on my laptop in the cafeteria to see how many employees looked at the stick, which says, this is a test and you failed. But there are always someone's going to go look at it. You speak to the greatest hackers in the world, they'll say to you, look, I can't get into Chase Bank. They spend literally $250 million a year on software, security software, every 12 months, just to keep me out of their bank. However, they employ 200,000 people worldwide. So someone, somewhere, is going to do something they're not supposed to do. All I do is sit and wait for doors to open. And when the doors open, I come in. And that's how every hack occurs. And as you know, we had the Office of Personnel Management. When I got that call from the Wall Street Journal the day it occurred, the agency said 4 million government employees had their identification stolen. So the Wall Street Journal was looking for a comment from me, and I said to the reporter, well, take that number and then times it by 5, and that's the true number. And certainly a few weeks later, they admitted to 21 million government employees, contractors, had their identities stolen from that office. 1.2 million fingerprints of government employees. Now, when you're an FBI agent or you work in a top secret clearance, you fill out Form 67. That's 164 pages that you fill out, listing all your relatives, friends, acquaintances, people you know, listing their personal information. All of that was gone as well. Now, this office had been hacked into 4 times previous to this. 4 times there were smaller hacks. They were told to fix the problem. They never fixed it. 4 times they went in and said, you have this loophole, you need to close it before somebody comes along and hacks a great deal of information. And finally, they did. Now, whether it's the Chinese government or was a gang in China, that's when we'll realize in 3 years from now, if we have a lot of federal employees start to see their information show up, people apply for credit in their name, mortgages in their name, credit cards in their name, then we'll know it was a Chinese gang who actually hacked into that Office of Personnel Management. But if we don't hear anything 5 years from now, 6 years from now, 7 years from now, no government employees had any problem, then we'll know it was the Chinese government who took it as simply a Trump card and will hold on to it. But who could blame them? If someone walked into a U.S. government office tomorrow and said, we can get into the Chinese government right now if we move fast and steal every Chinese federal employee's information, we'd have done the same thing. We let it happen. We opened the door and allowed them to do it. It was more our fault than their fault. We gave them the opportunity. We gave them the access. And that happens all the time. And this is an amazing hack, but just one of thousands of hacks that go on every single year, ones that are reported, some are not. This is an exception. The U.S. federal government is not required by law to report breaches like private businesses. They are forced to report this breach due to its size, but most of them we'd probably never hear about. But they occur all the time, and information being stolen. I am very concerned about the elderly, but as the Attorney General told you, the truth is, if you ask an identity thief whose information you'd rather have, a 2-year-old or a 62-year-old man worth several million dollars, they'll always take the 2-year-old. The 2-year-old has no credit. And for several years, the 2-year-old is not likely to seek any credit. So if I can become that 2-year-old, I can be that 2-year-old for a long period of time. To prove this point, Carnegie Mellon went across the country to interview 40,000 children in each age bracket through their parents or through the guardian or through the child themselves to simply ask the 40,000 children randomly if they'd been a victim of identity theft. 10% of them had already had their identities stolen. On the black market, a 2-year-old's identity goes for more money than a 14-year-old because, again, the 2-year-old has a much longer lifespan of that identity than the 14-year-old. So it is actually young children whose identities they're after. And that is why it is so important as parents and grandparents to teach our children to use social media sites and things in a proper way, which we'll get to, so that you protect them from having their information stolen and used, which they will not find out for years and years later that someone stole that information from them. Next, you're going to have, of course, Medicare fraud. That's going to be coming, and that is where I steal your identity, go down to a place and get some medical treatment, give them your information, your insurance company gets charged, you get charged, and you never know who actually stole your medical information or your information to get medical services. The scary part about this is your credit card is protected under the Consumer Fair Protection Credit Act, so you have no liability. However, this is not protected by that act. Because it's a new crime, there is no legislation. So a hospital or an insurance company could hold you liable for medical treatment that keep you responsible for the bill, as you see in many cases, without you ever having actually had those services, even though you proved it wasn't you, They still end up holding you liable for those services. By the end of 2013, 867 million electronic files had been hacked into in the United States. We have about 220, 230 million people in this country. They have already had their information hacked into. This is why I say everyone in this room, including me, has already had their information stolen. And this is, of course, the Carnegie Mellon study of those children. You know, when a lot of the older people in the audience, including myself, we didn't get our Social Security number until we got a job. So we were 16 years old, 17 years old. The government issued us a Social Security number. Three people knew the number: you, the government, and your employer. Today, a child is born in a hospital and given a Social Security number. And that means someone wants that number. And they can do a lot with that number. And that is why children are a very big concern of mine personally. Now, identity theft is not new. So people say, when you wrote that book, the crime had never been heard of. No, it was a known crime. We called it identity theft. But very few people ever heard about it because it was a crime that took a great deal of research and time and legwork. So you read the newspaper, and you read that Robert Jones was named Home Builder of the Year in Omaha. So you read the article, and it said that 10 years ago, Robert Jones filed bankruptcy. But he took the company out of bankruptcy, and today, the largest home builder in the Midwest. Well, 10 years ago, you went down to the federal bankruptcy court, and you walked in and got a copy of the bankruptcy filing. You fished it and microfished it out. You printed it out, you had his wife's signature, his date of birth, her date of birth, her Social Security number, and you stole their identity. The only difference today is all of these public records are accessible without me ever going there. From thousands of miles away in China, Eastern Bloc countries, Russia, I can access any of this through the Internet. So that same crime today has just become, through technology, a lot easier to do, and there is no face behind it. You will never see who committed the crime. And they're thousands of miles away, that even if we know who they are, the difficulty of trying to arrest them, prosecute them, bring them to justice is an extremely difficult thing to do. I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on LinkedIn. I'm not on Twitter. I have nothing against social media sites. I have three sons who are on them. So obviously, being a father, I taught them to use them properly. Right now, currently, we have 7.5 million children on Facebook under the age of 13 years old. Of those, 5 million more children are on Facebook under the age of 10 years old. Last year, we had over 1 million children bullied on Facebook. Many of them committed suicide. Their parents didn't even know they were being bullied on Facebook. When you have an opportunity, you go home on your computer, in the Google box, you type in the word creeper phone. Creeper phone. That's a software. It's very inexpensive. You could buy it. You load it onto your PC. Your child has a cell phone. They know where your child is every second of every day. It is nothing but a triangular search tool that searches a Facebook page back to the cell phone, back to the software. Knows where your child is every minute of the day. If you walk through the airport and I take your picture on an iPhone and snap your photograph, you use a technology called PIT. PAT. You can look that up, PITT-PAT, P-A-T-T, developed by MIT. PITPAT is a facial recognition software. If I take your photograph, in 7.5 seconds, it'll bring me to your Facebook page through facial recognition. If I get to your Facebook page and you happen to tell me where you were born and your date of birth, I'm 98% of stealing your identity. So a couple of weeks, I'll be up at Iowa State in Ames speaking to all the students up there. And when I do, I'm sure I'll get a question about Facebook. So I'll be telling them that you never want to put a straight photograph of yourself on Facebook. Always a picture with you with a group of your friends, your arms are around them, you're playing tennis, you're playing soccer, you're playing volleyball, you're doing some activity. Remember that the more photos you have of yourself on Facebook, the quicker the facial recognition software works because it gathers all the photos to make that facial recognition. And you never, ever want to state on your Facebook page where you were born and your date of birth. Otherwise, you might as well just say, come steal my identity. PitPat is just one of many facial recognition softwares that get better and better all the time. Technology gets better and better all the time. And criminals will use technology in a negative, self-serving way for their benefit. 4 years ago, Fortune magazine interviewed 4,000 U.S. companies, said, do you look at someone's Facebook when you go to hire them? Back then, 63% of them said, of course. Do you make a decision to hire them based on what you read? 35%. That was 4 years ago. It's a lot higher today. If the federal government is about to hire you tomorrow, they're going to go look at your Facebook page. Well, privacy button means nothing. They're going to look at your Facebook page. If there's a picture of you, nude on the beach, with a bunch of drug paraphernalia all over your body, wine bottles and whiskey bottles, they're probably not going to hire you. If you're 12 years old and you just read a book on building bombs, and because you're 12 years old, you get on Facebook and tell your friends that you like to build bombs, you'd like to build a big bomb. 8 years later, when you apply to the University of Nebraska and they look at your Facebook page, all they see is, I like to build bombs. As most HR people say, the question is, did they say, I like to build bombs 12 minutes ago or when they were actually 12 years old? That I don't know. Remember, what you say on Facebook stays on Facebook. You can remove it, but it's retrievable. What you send to the cloud can come back from the cloud. So you have to be very careful and teach your children that what they say on Facebook, things they do on Facebook, statements they make on Facebook, can come back to haunt them. Today, it is so easy to just go to Google and type someone's name. You don't have to be. 5 years ago, you had to be a little bit of a celebrity, a little bit of famous. You were a governor, you were a legislator, you were a mayor, you were somebody, and they got able to Google your name. Today, I just type in someone's name, Lincoln, Nebraska, and they give me everything about that person. Information is everywhere. This is why even good security. I worked with LexisNexis and Experian for years to develop what we call KBA. This is when you go on your computer from some other source and they don't recognize you, so they say, we're going to ask you 5 security questions, multiple choice. And so they might ask you a question like, did you ever own one of these cars? Ford, Chevrolet, Suburban, boom. Years ago, no one knew that but you. But today, there is so much information out there that all I would do is go research the Department of Motor Vehicles records to see if you ever owned a Suburban, so that when they ask me that question, I'll be able to answer that question. What's your pet's name? What's your mother's maiden name? Where'd you last vacation? You told me that on Facebook. Where are you going on your vacation? What hotel did you stay at? What restaurants did you eat at? All the questions that used to work don't work because we know all that information, and that information today is easily accessible. 2.7 billion hits every day Facebook gets. I like this restaurant, I don't like this restaurant, I like this hotel, I don't like this hotel. Each one of them is recorded every day, and this is them speaking, not me, and they profile them back to your Facebook page. So the reality is, in 6 months, Facebook says they know your gender, your age, your sexual orientation, your voting record, your IQ, your religion, your politics, whether you smoke, whether you use drugs. Why would you want someone to know all those things about you? We give away so much information about ourselves and then wonder why people are able to take away our identities from us, because we allow them to do so with so much information. Fraud Watch is a great program. I have to tell you, when AARP approached me, I have spent my 40 years out speaking to banks. So my audience are either the bankers in the audience or their Fortune 500 customers. I've been here for Union Pacific. I've been here for First National Bank of Omaha. I've been here for many banks around the world. But my audience are Fortune 500 companies, corporations, businesses, and financial institutions. So I never get to speak directly to consumers. I write articles, I write books, but I never get to go out and help who really needs to be helped. If you're a small business and someone defrauds you of $130,000 on some forged checks and the bank refuses to pay them because you didn't notify them within the 30-day limit of notification, you're out of business. If you're Delta Airlines, you have errors and omissions insurance. You write off the $100,000. You get insured for the $100,000. You write off the $30,000 deductible, and you go on about your business. The smaller you are, the more you have to lose. So when AARP said, look, what we want to do is take you out to 8 cities across the country and speak directly to people in the audience. Well, they don't have to be an AARP member. We don't charge any fee. We don't want you to sell anything. We're not going to sell anything. We just want you to go and educate these consumers. I felt that was a unique opportunity I couldn't pass up for me to get out in front of people who really need to hear this and learn how to protect themselves. The one thing I learned over the 40 years of lecturing is that if you tell people what their risks are, and they're smart enough to understand their risks. They're smart enough to go do something about it, as long as you're not trying to sell them something. And that's what I hope you learned something today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Frank Abagnale, author of several books, including The Art of the Steal, Stealing Your Life, and his autobiography, written with Stan Redding, Catch Me If You Can, which was made into a major motion picture in 2002, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hanks, directed by Steven Spielberg. Mr. Abagnale has advised the FBI for over four decades on how to outsmart con artists. In recent years, he's joined forces with the AARP Fraud Watch Network and AARP Nebraska. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 10, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Deborah Lanner of AARP Nebraska for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.